It is sometimes hard, almost impossible, to the non-Brooklynite to describe the real essence of Coney Island in a few short, sweet phrases. Down to its withering bones, the degradation, the corruption, the sadist smile of Tilly strung out across the town. Coney's faded glory will never exactly fit the definition of sweet or heavenly. The old Coney, the Coney I remember, the rides, the food, all are pleasant memories dancing in the hearts of every scrappy short kid with a couple of bucks, subway tokens, and an imagination as vast as the Atlantic. To me, it will always be the old Sodom by the sea. Back in the days when Brooklyn seemed like the apex of the world, grappling at the edge of the earth, clinging onto a fantasy that never fully came true. No matter how many times we come and go, one belongs to Coney instantly, forever harmonizing with its swan song. We look at the photographs from our ancestors, Dreamland, Luna Park, Steeplechase, standing erect like high-rises in a corroded, dreamlike awe, wondering if these pictures were a reality or, in fact, a figment of our imaginations. Perhaps the true Coney Island is not physical or palatable. The real Coney Island may only exist in our minds, if we care to dream. Poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti calls this a Coney Island of the mind, a circus of the soul. To this day, I can still ride the F train down to Stillwell Avenue, look down at my old neighborhood and smile. It's the Coney Island of my mind. This is the actual Coney Island, an oasis of teetering skeletons buried at sea. But don't let the reality of Coney scare you. Coney's downfalls are only human, and the imperfections only make it achingly real. The parachute jump no longer operates, but still sings. The neglected Terracotta Child's Restaurant on West 21st Street has been closed for many years, but the golden age still lives on. The out-of-town is still shuffling, fanny-packed, armed with disposable cameras, expecting a dreamland. That's not the case. Dreamland is dead. The fantasies are over. Sometimes I stroll on the boardwalk, watching the lights go down on Astroland. Maybe I'm the only one left watching, to think they could all be gone in a few short years. Breaks my heart. I still come back to Coney, no matter how much it hurts to say goodbye each time. I come back to Coney for hope that one day I'll return to Dreamland.
To enter Steeplechase, you had to walk under the toothy smile of a tremendous joker face named George C. Tillyou. Then you'd stumble through a huge rotating barrel, losing your balance and your loose change. There were all kinds of rides, games, and refreshment stands, plus an indoor arena with more rides. For one ride, you had to climb up a ladder, go down a spiral slide, and land on one of several revolving turntables. You had to keep your arms crossed to avoid getting wood burned. On another ride, you started out in the raised center of a large round thing that rotated so fast you would be automatically pulled to the side and held against the wall by centrifugal force, even when the floor was lowered. You hoped you wouldn't throw up from the hot dog, malted milk, and French fries you'd eaten, because the vomit would fly right back in your face unless you turned your head at just the right moment. Timing was important. At the end of the arena, there was a theater. You could sit in the audience, eat your lunch, and watch regular people, not actors, who kept coming out of a door onto the stage, which was a miniature funhouse. They would have to walk across a wooden platform that jiggled and shook, struggling to keep their balance. A one-inch diameter hole in the floor emitted a spout of air up a female's skirt as she passed over that portion of the stage, and the audience would applaud. Occasionally, a woman wouldn't be wearing panties or a bathing suit underneath, and there would be a flash of her pubic hair. Then the audience would applaud with extra appreciation.
Jóvenes chicanos in white tees or rayon shirts tight and open, dungarees, walk down the beach in threes, drink bud, and look at pussy. Pobrecitos, who never see the sweet chicanas naked, cause the girls come always with baby brothers, little sisters, or infants all their own. Jóvenes chicanos stroll casual and sit on rocks below the cemetery to flash on the brown blondes who walk quivering out of the sea, skin tight as tambourines, here from probably New Jersey or Venus, then drink their buds down slow and keep on walking.
Some women knew what to expect, and they would hold their skirts down. But for this contingency, there was a dwarf dressed in a clown costume, wearing makeup that endowed him with an angry expression, waiting on stage for them. With an electric cattle prod, he would buzz a woman in the buttocks so that her hands would instinctively go toward the shock, letting go of her skirt. Then the air spout would be effective again. I was still obsessed with pubic hair, but I was truly offended by this method of revealing it. Although I was now an atheist, I continued to ask myself, is this what God intended? My parents had told me to act normal, but I was confused by what passed for normality. The most popular ride was the steeplechase horses. They were like merry-go-round horses, except that they didn't travel rooted in a circle. They were not impaled on a carousel. Rather, they moved individually on elevated tracks, up and down hills, around the perimeter of the park, so that you could see the ocean, the beach, the boardwalk, and rides such as the tilt-a-whirl, the whip, the parachute jump. The steeplechase horses operated mechanically, but it seemed like you could make them go faster by pelvic thrusts alone. When the ride ended, you had to walk down a passageway to an exit door, which turned out to be the entrance to that stage. This was the only way out, so you instantly became a captive performer. After I rode the steeplechase horses, I came through the door and saw that the dwarf in the clown costume was standing at the edge of the stage with his back toward me, talking to someone in the front row. His electric cattle prod was leaning against the railing. I knew that I had to make a decision immediately. Time froze. The left, more rational lobe of my brain warned, "You must realize that if you turn his own electric cattle prod on him, it will definitely change the dynamics of this encounter and inevitably result in hostile vibes." The right, more impulsive lobe of my brain queried, "How can you resist this temptation? You'll regret it for the rest of your life if you don't seize the opportunity right now. You'll never get a chance like this again." And in that split second, while time froze, the left and right lobes of my brain fused. Impulse and choice became the same process. Having my retrospect in advance, I realized what I had to do in order to avoid regret. I picked up the electric cattle prod and buzzed the dwarf clown in his buttocks. He jumped away, just as he made countless others jump away. The audience cheered and applauded wildly. Suddenly I was a hero, but not to the dwarf clown. He was fuming. He chased me off the stage, shaking his fist and cursing me out. He continued to run after me, around the cotton candy stand and in between the Dodgem scooter cars. There was a certain dreamlike quality to this, being chased around an amusement park by a dwarf in a clown costume because I had just buzzed him in the ass with his own electric cattle prod. So I began to flap my arms like wings while I was running. Since I didn't fly, I knew it wasn't a dream. This was reality. In fact, it was the most exciting ride, literally and figuratively.
Constantly risking absurdity and death whenever he performs above the heads of his audience, the poet, like an acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making, and balancing on high beams above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing entrechats and sleight of foot tricks and other high theatrics, and all without mistaking anything for what it may not be.
Ciao! Third International, Amal Nitro's Soviet Surplus Floating Fortress of Fun. The famous five-ring sensual circus of the sea aboard the once dangerous, now fabulous aircraft carrier, Stalyagi. Third International. And here's your host, your first mate, and chief petting officer, Randy Rocknoodle.
Dinky-dinky-dinky-donka-donka-ding-dang-tongs. And welcome here we're again beyond the three-mile limit of your wildest explanations. This is the world where beautiful people, tender animals, and high-voltage robots get it together. And here it is, Dirty Show with me in the center ring, our ring master, automatic Captain Kurt Slowman.
Welcome aboard, Surf International. A greeting to all of you who are here and to all of you who are not here.
Yes, folks, we're being watched tonight by satellite.
But the TV tourists are not going to see but half the fun.
The top half.
Yes, the dumb forces of international law and fundamental human decency prevent us from focusing our cameras on
the dizzy display of instinctive primitive appetites
as the cannibals and the animals eat each other in ring number four.
Nor can we let the cameras reveal
the shameless shenanigans of Duar and McDonald, the Irish Explorer.
No, McDonald!
Former mailmen, now all mailmen. You can't see them as they meet in ring number two.
The black holes. Sinless sisters from inner space.
Men disappear into them.
They disappear into themselves.
It's magic.
Surf International.
And in ring number five. Forget it. Only the living will be able to see.
The daring Hintons, a liberated middle class family performing dangerous acts of love with unpredictable stimuli and stimulants.
United at last with Bruto and Thrasher. German police dogs trained to sniff marijuana, now with their warm noses in another bush.
Polly and I went to the circus, and Polly got hit with a rolling pin. We got even with the bought tickets, but we didn't go win.
You mean you have playback circuits?
Circus? You should have seen the circus I used to have. Playing up and down the Rocky Mountains, the first Zepp carnival in the world, always arrived disguised as a thunderstorm. Motion is hair. People have no...
No, I meant circuits.
I know what you meant, amigo. Certainly I have the necessary equipment. You've been away a long time. It's all Astro surplus now.
And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not catch her fair eternal form, spread eagle in the empty air of existence.
Ferlinghetti's extraordinary life has been anything but quiet. It's the stuff of movie scripts, but the challenge would be to keep it from becoming melodrama, especially in the telling of his early life story.
I had an unhappy childhood. I saw Lindbergh land. I looked homeward and saw no angel.
Lawrence was born at home in Yonkers, New York, into an atmosphere of anguish.
Santa Monica, 1936. My day begins. The Western Ocean slides up to Louis B. Mayer's private beach and leaves a slug's breath of cold foam behind. It's a gray, woolen December morning. I am a few hours old.
His father, an auctioneer in Little Italy, had moved the family into the cultural melting pot of suburbia, but he died suddenly before Lawrence was born, leaving his mother and two brothers destitute.
I am looking for my old man whom I never knew. I am looking for the lost leader with whom I flew.
When his mother's despair deepened, she was institutionalized. To Lawrence's rescue from across the Atlantic came Aunt Emily.
Emily Monsanto, she was French, Portuguese, but she was a flapper.
So I thought I'd never meet Joe from Chicago, see? You know, we got a friend in common.
Oh, really?
Jim Fang, see?
Oh, Jim C. Fang.
Yeah.
Yes, I knew him.
Yeah.
Well, I may have bumped into him once.
Ah, that's rich. Bumped him off, you mean? Hey, honey, you're a swell flapper. What's under the flap?
Watch it there, bug eyes. Keep your peepers off my mole.
A mole?
Who's the professor?
Oh, well, I'm a practicing physician, sir.
Well, when you stop practicing, see? I got a couple of slugs in my back garden, see? I want removed, see?
This is talking about the 1920s. It says she wore cloche hats and was quite crazy. I mean, I wrote a poem about her.
A real flapper with the high heels and the stockings and the hat and the beads?
I think so. As I remember, all I really remember is the cloche hat.
Aunt Emily whisked the newborn Lawrence to France to live with her, and so Ferlinghetti's first language was French, a critical factor in his later years, both in the military and in poetry. Ferlinghetti didn't return to the U.S. until he was of school age. The French Aunt Emily took a job as governess in the mansion of a wealthy New York family. In the home's library, young Lawrence was exposed to classic literature and poetry, and good food and care helped him grow strong. But his comfortable surroundings hardly made up for the next twist in his early fate. Emily Monsanto, the only mother he had ever known, walked away one day and was never heard from again.
I once started out to walk around the world, but ended up in Brooklyn. That bridge was too much for me.
At the age of 9, another traumatic turn of events. Lawrence's birth mother and two brothers showed up one morning at the mansion he now called home. After visiting for an hour, he was asked to decide, at the age of 9, where he wanted to live, with his mom and brothers, whom he didn't know, or the caring but unaffectionate rich folks he did. He stayed where he was.
I have engaged in silence, exile, and cunning. I flew too near the sun, and my wax wings fell off.
After the great stock market crash, Lawrence was moved once again, this time to a loving family in the suburbs. He devoted himself to the Boy Scouts, yet began to run with the wild ones, too. He joined a street gang.
I got caught stealing pencils from the 5- and 10-cent store the same month I made Eagle Scout.
To straighten him out, young Lawrence was sent away to boarding school in Massachusetts.
When I went there, it was a farm school, a work school where everyone worked the farm. He got up at 5 in the morning and milked the cows. And it was very hard academically. And it was founded by Dwight L. Moody, the Bible-thumping evangelist.
The Bible-thumping was lost on young Lawrence. He would grow up with a distaste for organized religion. But there was one impromptu philosophy lesson at the Mount Hermon Preparatory School for Boys that made a lasting impression. It came in a wrestling match. An older student, who would later become valedictorian at Yale, pinned Lawrence to the floor to pose a pointed existential question.
We had an argument about how can you prove you really exist. And finally I had to admit I couldn't prove it. So then he let me up. But then when I went to Paris, I often saw Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir sitting in the Brasserie Leap. And, of course, I was a totally unknown graduate student at the Sorbonne. I wouldn't dare go up and say, "Est-ce que tu existes vraiment?" Do you really exist? So I didn't have a chance to ask him that, unfortunately. I had the chance, but I didn't have the nerve.
Turn right. right in either direction at Sartre's No Exit of the Mobius Strip.
Okay, remember that. That's right where Zeno's paradise is, Mud.
Avoid the headless hitchhiker in your ETA by Blair Midnight, boys.
All right, it sounds like we're cool, so, well, go take a look at the load, Mud.
Well, I'd rather not, Orge.
Well, why not?
Well, you know, every time I look at it, yeah, oh, there it is. It's looking back at me.
Sartre's No Exit, 1/8 mile.
It sounds like the highway patrol.
Hey, that cop's got both gumballs spinning. We're doomed.
Sarge's No Exit, 1/16 mile.
Well, shall we pull over?
Oh, we got fuzz up our muffler.
Sarge's No Exit, 1/32
mile. I'm taking the No Exit.
Ferlinghetti first went to France as an adult, the hard way, as part of the D-Day invasion force. He captained a small naval craft.
I landed in Normandy in a rowboat that turned over. I have seen the ignorant armies on the beach at Dover.
During the war, he commanded a submarine chaser, and after victory in Europe, went inland, where in France, he discovered the work of surrealist poet Jacques Prévert. Prévert would have great influence on Ferlinghetti's own work.
I have heard 100 housebroken Ezra Pounds. They should all be freed. It is long since I was a herdsman.
Before he mustered out of the Navy, Lawrence Ferlinghetti had walked through Nagasaki 6 weeks after the bomb that ended the war in the Pacific.
You tried to win a war.
Oh, shit on a stick, Franklin. You started one.
But, Mr. President, I dropped the goddamn bomb.
You really gave him hell, Harry, son.
If you can't stand the heat, stay out of Nagasaki.
But I am the man, and I'll be there. And I may cause the lips of those who are asleep to speak. And I may make my notebooks into sheaves of grass. And I may write my own eponymous epitaph, instructing the horsemen to pass.
Nice Paisley horsey. Give the nice horsey some sugar cubes.
The years between the war and the 1960s were almost as tumultuous as his life had been before, but this tumult was self-driven. After a stint as junior journalist at Time magazine in New York, Ferlinghetti set off to follow his passion for painting and poetry. He studied at the Sorbonne and took on the classic bohemian lifestyle of the itinerant artist in Paris.
I traveled by rail to Paris. I had a chance to see the famous war countryside, which bears few reminders of that grim time, 1958 to 1959. France has been the field of more wars than anyone. The French must love being raped at some level, a level about halfway up. Paris turned up at the Gare du Nord, or Northern Glare, and I was instantly disenchanted. Paris is much too like New York to be any good. No one speaks English, just like New York. He's having a wonderful, wonderful time. It seems he was at the Eiffel Waffle, and he got a chance to use his only piece of French, which is J'ai une pièce de résistance, or things are looking up. That's what he said to the driver, exhausting it. One blow, there's the blow again, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
His entire knowledge of French in himself. So he's coming home.
He was talking about the resistance movement, though.
Right. Home on the Range, the resistance movement.
Mm.
And when he returned to America, Lawrence Ferlinghetti headed for a city where the bohemian felt at home.
When I arrived in San Francisco from Paris, I was still wearing my beret in 1951. It was the last bohemians were still around then.
Back around the turn of the century, San Francisco thought of itself as the Athens of America, or at least of the West.
Ferlinghetti biographer and poet Neely Cherkovsky. We are chatting at Puccini's, a busy sidewalk cafe on Columbus Avenue.
We enjoyed being here. Because of the old bohemian tradition that went back to the 30s.
Cherkovsky is a poetry professor and the author of such books as Whitman's Wild Children and, from 1979, Ferlinghetti, a Biography.
One of the first persons who became part of the Beat Generation to come here was Ferlinghetti. In I think 51 he came here. He sailed across the bay and he talks about the city being like a little white city in North Africa, like coming into the harbor of Tunis. And he wandered up Market Street into North Beach and he said, you know, it was the smell of the French bread and the aroma of the Italian wine.
Say what it is. Yo, buddy, Tuck's the luck down here in hell with the word on my favorite firewater, upper middle-class wine. Now, Dick, you remember how you felt when you wheeled and dealed your way to the top of the heap, not caring whose throat got cut or whose feet you stepped on, but how about the time you drew up that petition to keep that colored family out of your exclusive all-white neighborhood? Or how about the way you bought your way out of all those traffic tickets? Remember how you felt? Proud, maybe a little guilty, but only for a second, and super thirsty. Yeah, scamming your way to the top of the heap can help you work up a powerful thirst, and it takes a powerful wine to quench it. Upper middle-class wine, the wine that sends more people to hell than money. So be a master blaster, be the boss with the hot sauce, be an always dapper late-night rapper, and maintain your aristocratic badness, baby, down here in hell. With the bold, distinctive, aristocratic taste of upper middle-class wine. So if you like to swill and you live up on the hill, give yourself a thrill and pick up a bottle or two of upper middle-class wine, because rich or poor, it's a hell of a way to go. Upper middle-class wine, the wine that plays favorites, sold in supermarkets and country clubs everywhere.
And it's...
You have it to vegetarian special?
Yeah. And it's still that way today. North Beach is still, thank you, dominated by that.
I was there first in 1948 when I got out of high school and worked as a carpenter's helper.
Musician, composer, and author David Amram.
And it was just an amazing, wide-open, warm, incredible place.
Amram has been a chronicler, a collaborator, and a friend of the late Jack Kerouac. Kerouac invented the term beat for the so-called lost generation born between the world wars. He later despised the beat label, which would stereotype North Beach poets, but he embraced the term bohemian.
Bohemian does not imply moronic slob. The opera La Bohème by Puccini is one of the most popular operas in the world, and it's talking about a wonderful, free, warm, life-embracing approach that anyone can have in their life, even if you're working in a factory. When I worked in the post office, when I was done, and then I go home and write music for a while, I could go to the different places where Jack and I would hang out, and we could have that La Vie Bohemienne.
Bohemians, though, need day jobs. Lawrence Ferlinghetti began reviewing poetry for the San Francisco Chronicle. In 1953, he went into business with a friend, opening City Lights Books. It quickly became the heart of the poetry district.
There was a great tendency to go over there and kind of hang out.
Poet Michael McClure.
There wasn't anything like City Lights anywhere else in any part of the world that I'd ever seen before. And you didn't have to buy a book. You could read a book, and none of us had any money.
Michael McClure arrived from the American Midwest in 1954, barely out of his teens, and passionate for the creative life as painter and poet.
One of the first things I noticed about Lawrence, this would probably be before I read any of his poems, but when I first walked into City Lights, or at least one of my first trips in there, I was greatly taken with his paintings. And a number of his paintings were sort of like modestly put in corners or little alcoves in a bookstore. And they were extraordinarily beautiful abstract expressionist paintings.
Sarolia's women in their picture hats, stretched upon his canvas beaches, beguiled the Spanish impressionists.
Hello, recognize these teeth? I'm Art Snob, and I'm speaking for Mr. Leonardo's Warehouse of Eternal Art. Move the Louvre to your own den or patio with this indoor, outdoor, all-weather art. These beautiful paintings are oil on astroturf by great masters, and each painting is signed by someone. All your favorite subjects. Bulls, panthers, clowns, hobos, sad-eyed orphans. Look at these. Panthers eating clowns. Orphans roasting hobos. Sad-eyed bulls goring crying orphans. This is your rugged, year-round art. Perfect for your patio or under your car. Here's how to order.
That's Mr. Leonardo's Warehouse of Eternal Art at 82 Haunted Shopping Mall Highway in King's Nose. Offer not valid in states covered by active consumer fraud statutes.
Call extension 95 and order now before it's too late.
Hearing the term cultural center, you might envision a certain kind of place. Maybe a white-walled art gallery run on government grants. But a cultural center can be something a little more messy and organic. Take one of the best-known bookstores in the world.
I think one of the powers of City Lights from its initial moments, that it wasn't just a bookstore, it was a powerful, powerful symbol of and desire for people to be able to get together, to share ideas, and to have a common space be able to do that. The way that Lawrence says it, it's like once we opened the doors, we couldn't get them shut.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti co-founded City Lights Booksellers and Publishers in San Francisco in the mid-1950s.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Can I help you?
Yes. Do you have a copy of 30 Days in the Samarkand Desert with the Duchess of Kent by A.E.J. Elliott, O.B.E.?
Well, I don't know the book, sir.
Never mind. How about 101 Ways to Start a Fight?
By?
An Irish gentleman whose name eludes me for the moment.
No, we haven't got it in stock, sir.
Not to worry. Can you help me with David Copperfield?
Ah, yes, Dickens.
No.
A big one?
No, Edmund Wells.
I think you'll find Charles Dickens wrote David Copperfield, sir.
No. Dickens wrote David Copperfield with two P's. This is David Copperfield with one P by Edmund Wells.
David Copperfield with one P?
Yes, I should have said.
Yes, well, in that case, we don't have it.
Funny, you've got a lot of books here.
Yes, we do, but we don't have David Copperfield with one P by Edmund Wells.
Are you quite sure?
Quite.
Not worth just looking?
Definitely not.
How about Great Expectations?
Yes, well, we have that.
That's G-R-A-T-E Expectations, also by Edmund Wells.
Yes, well, in that case, we don't have it. We don't have anything by Edmund Wells, actually. He's not very popular.
Not Nicholas Nickleby? That's K-N-I-C-K-E-R-L-E-S-S?
No.
Christmas Carol with a K?
No.
How about A Sale of Two Titties?
Definitely not.
Sorry to trouble you.
Not at all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh!
Yes?
I wonder if you might have a copy of Barnaby Budge.
No, as I say, we're right out of Edmund Wells.
No, not Edmund Wells, Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens?
Yes.
You mean Barnaby Rudge?
No, Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens. That's Dickens with two K's, the well-known Dutch author.
No, well, we don't have Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens with two K's, the well-known Dutch author, and perhaps to save time, I should add that we don't have Carnaby Fudge by Dahl's Chickens, or Farnborough Sludge by Miles Pickens, or even Stickwick Stapers by Fowles Wickens with four M's and a silent Q. Why don't you try W.H. Smith's?
I did. They sent me here.
Did they?
I wonder...
Oh, do go on, please.
I wonder if you might have The Amazing Adventures of Captain Gladys Stoat pamphlet and her intrepid spaniel Stig amongst the giant pygmies of Beckles. Volume 8.
No, we don't have that. Funny, we got a lot of books here. Well, I mustn't keep you standing here.
Well, do you
no,
have...
We haven't. No, we haven't. Sorry, it's 1 o'clock now. We're closing for lunch.
I saw it over there.
What?
I saw it over there. Olson's Standard Book of British Birds.
Olson's Standard Book of British Birds?
Yes.
O-L-S-E-N?
Yes.
B-I-R-D-S?
Yes.
Yes, well, we do have that, as a matter of fact.
The expurgated version.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
The expurgated version.
The expurgated version of Olson's Standard Book of British Birds?
The one without the gannet.
The one without the gannet? They've all got the gannet. It's a standard British bird, the gannet. It's in all the books.
Well, I don't like them. They wet their nests.
All right, I'll remove it. Any other birds you don't like?
I don't like the robin.
The robin? Right, the robin. There you are. Any others you don't like? Any others?
The nuthatch.
Right, the nuthatch. Here we are. There you are. No gannets, no robins, no nuthatches. There's your book.
I can't buy that. It's torn. I wonder if you have...
Come on, ask me anything. We got lots of books here, you know. It's a bookshop.
How about Biggles combs his hair?
No, no, we don't have that one for me.
The Gospel According to Charlie Drake?
No, 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 try me again.
I know. Ethel the Aardvark goes quantity surveying.
No, 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 no. What, what?
Ethel the Aardvark goes quantity surveying.
Ethel the I've got it! I've seen it somewhere! I know what it has! Someone, yes! Yes! Here we are! Ethel the Aardvark goes quantity surveying! There's your book! Now, buy it!
I don't have enough money.
I'll take a deposit.
I don't have any money.
I'll take a check.
I don't have a checkbook.
I'll take a black one.
I haven't got a bank account.
Right! I'll buy it for you! Here you are. There's your change. There's some money for a taxi on the way home. There's your book.
Wait,
now,
wait,
now,
wait.
What?
I can't read.
You can't read. Right. Sit down. Sit there. Are you sitting comfortably? Right. Ethel the Aardvark was hot.
He soon came to wider attention for publishing a paperback collection, including the long poem Howl by Allen Ginsberg. It was a cri de cœur with language and political views that scandalized mid-century America. Ferlinghetti was charged with obscenity, but ultimately won a landmark victory at trial. Howl stands as one of the best-known English language poems of the 20th century and is still in print. With all of that, City Lights became an anti-establishment literary haven, first for the Beat Generation, then for the punk rock zine crowd, and always for rule breakers, American dissidents, and writers of unruly imagination.
This is Major Hit in the cockpit of the Enola McLuhan, flagship of the 7th Airborne Peace Corps and Lending Library. We're now over the center of rebel resistance in northern Nigeria and preparing to drop literature.
Do the Bombay door thing. Bombay door swinging and open, baby. Moving and out. Bombardier, it's your karma.
We're almost ready to drop it. I can see the entire rebel force running out of their huts, looking up at the sky.
7, 14, 11, 16, ready. Hunks away!
There they go. The literature is in a tight pattern. The rebels are beginning to scatter, but it's too late. On target. God, this is an awesome moment. The last stronghold of unhip resistance is out of sight. Under 8 million hardbound copies of The Naked Lunch, it's all over.
For that reason, the store has remained a beacon for different generations of seekers and young people.
Well, this is sort of like a pilgrimage for me. Ginsberg, Kerouac, Ferlinghetti are kind of idols of mine, in a sense. I mean, Ferlinghetti had the guts to challenge everything, challenge the establishment. I mean, we wouldn't have some of the writers we have nowadays if it wasn't for him.
So I call for a union of consciences, and I prophesy a new messiah, because everybody is God, and it's about time they seized power in the universe and took over the means of communication and started communicating. Why haven't you published another book since Howl and other poems? Well, because I didn't think I had anything that was as beautiful and strong enough yet. And then I left out about 3 years' work, 55 to 58, though there's some good work in that. That's a book I'll publish, maybe sooner or later, or wait until I get a collected poems. I don't know. It's too much trouble to type all that up and then send it out. And then I also felt proud of Howl and wanted to do something finer. Vanity. Well, things seem quiet right now. Right this minute, yes, the interregnum. I think that we are now coming to a point of a kind of unification of cosmos and consciousness, or something, I don't know, something big is happening consciously to consciousness. Everybody's getting hip. It's like, sort of like a question. Will the people accept the new consciousness or vomit it up in an atomic bomb? But it doesn't make any difference what the answer is, because nothing can be destroyed, really. What was there is always there, so that's all right, I suppose. So civilization's got to alter, I suppose, and consciousness. All the realities have got to alter. And there are the dinosaurs who don't want to alter, poor dinosaurs. Part of it is the acceleration of mass media, the acceleration that we're actually leaving the planet. Wow, that's happening physically. So what happens mentally at a time like that with such fantastic complexity? Oh, well, it's silly. But I'd put my money on something interesting happening. I put my poetry on it, so to speak. I put my life on for it, I think. I guess it'll be the same old thing happening again. And what is the same old thing? We are all one. Man is one. Man is brothers, or amor vincit omnia, was what I thought the other day. Love conquers all through all the universes. Do you think a poet can ever accomplish anything toward this? Christ did for what he accomplished. Buddha did. Whitman did. Or he certainly set something going in public consciousness, a sign to people that certainly wakes people up. Blake did. Do you think poets are leading this? No. I think people are leading it. I don't know whether poets lead it. It would be lovely if they were. Poets should lead it. Poets should be the legislators of the world, as Shelley said. Everybody should lead it. Musicians lead it. Painters lead it. Everybody doing the same thing. Even the poor, lonely stenographer hurrying home from work with a tear in her eye is a part of the great process. And now everybody's having visions. That's what it boils down to. Really, truly having visions. And now there are these new wisdom drugs, in a sense, lysergic acid, mescaline. Many, many people have taken peyote now, thousands and thousands, and it's legal. And it's freedom of religion. It's inescapable. People are beginning to see that the kingdom of heaven is within them instead of thinking it's outside up in the sky and that it can't be here on earth. It's time to seize power in the universe. That's what I say. That's my political statement. Time to seize power over the entire universe, not merely over Russia and America. Seize power over the moon. Take the sun over. You're in favor of space travel? Mm-hmm. That's a funny image of everybody getting in a big spaceship and going out to explore the universe, taking all their money, and instead of stuffing it into war materials, making big cooperative projects, this great being of man to search the skies, see if there are any friends out there, make contact with the sunflower monkeys of Uranus.
Sometime during eternity, some guys show up, and one of them who shows up real late is a kind of carpenter from some square type place like Galilee. And he starts wailing and claiming he is Hep to who made heaven and earth, and that the cat who really laid it on us is his dad.
There's no doubt about it that the sense of cool that Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and people like that had was absolutely borrowed by the poets.
Neely Tchaikovsky.
The hey, it's cool, man, and things like that. That all comes out of the parlance of the black jazz musicians. Friendly Getty has a poem, and it's borrowed from Lord Buckley, who was a black rap kind of comedian of the 40s and 50s, and who spoke in this cool rap, and that was borrowed by the Beats.
You're hot, they tell him, and they cool him. They stretch him on the tree to cool. And everybody after that is always making models of this tree with him hung up, and always crooning his name and calling him to come down and sit in on their combo as if he is the king cat who's got to blow.
Well, I'm gonna put a cat on you was the sweetest, gonest, wailingest cat that ever stomped on this sweet swinging sphere. And they called this your cat Benaz. That was the cat's name. He was a carpenter kitty. Now, Benaz was a kind of a cat that come on so wild and so sweet and so strong and so witted that when he laid it, wham, it stayed there.
One of the professional stances of people who made their fame and their many fortunes off of the Beat Generation say, well, I'm not a beatnik.
Neely Tchaikovsky.
It's a cool gesture. It's a good PR gesture. But it does bring up an interesting point. There were these three people, William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, and Allen Ginsberg, and these three like-minded people met each other in New York City in the 40s and shared a lot of experiences, and they were all writers of one kind or another. And these guys got together, and then in 1950, they met Gregory Corso, the kind of the enfant terrible of the Beats. And they worked very hard at their writing, and they were not revolutionaries, they were great rebels. They were not anti-American. They were very understanding of America and its capacities and its values and its lack of values. But they were ultimate rebels. They believed the only way America could survive and grow and change and prosper and ripple across time is to allow for what Kerouac would later call the unspeakable visions of the individual.
The extra hours here, right?
So they put a name on it in the late 50s called Beats, Beat Generation.
Who put a name on it?
The monster media, you know.
And the monster media forever tattooed Lawrence Ferlinghetti as Dean of the Beats.
Think of Dean Moriarty. I even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. Think of Dean Moriarty. I think of Dean Moriarty.
He related to many of them well, not just as a publisher, but as friends and comrades, steeped in an understanding of classic literature and art, and in a growing political awakening in the era of Cold War paranoia and in the rapid decline of the ecology.
Well, the Beat poets were the first to articulate any environmental consciousness, as far as I know.
Mick Jagger playing on the jukebox, ducks struggling in oily water, cars going by loud and out of place, 55-year-old workmen who know how to fix their campers, handing buckets of crap to hippies and taking buckets of crap from hippies, and me crying in a Mexican cafe because I can feel paradise so close now for everybody. I think we got most of the birds out of the south end of the bay, he says, taking off his pink anodized hard hat and wiping some sweat off his forehead right where his thinning pack of black-gray hair begins. The hippie is falling asleep over his coffee. Across the street, in front of the Sunset Beauty Salon, the sidewalk is turning gray and shifting and melting as 1,000 years pass, and flowers and Indian tobacco and sage and people looking a little Chinese spring up out of the street. The beauty salon is a field now with two people making love by a brown rock. I'll cry any day for that. My vision starts in my feet and goes down, so my crying is really like rain. My tears make the years pass like a rush. My tears make the seeds grow under Sunset Boulevard. The clump of cane by the brown rock is the 1,000-year-old child of my tears, and that boy is the 1,000-year-old child of that hard hat, and that girl filled with him, her sweet self coming with a cry in the California clay, is the 1,000-year child of that hippie. And the ducks made it too. So don't despair. Learn to hold back and let it out like the Stones' guitar. The war is over. We're home. And when we all wake up, we'll all be friends. Dear friends.
And these, the main themes of Beat poetry were really precursors of what became the main themes of the 1960s hippie counterculture. And so as if the Beats were really Stone Age hippies, turning toward the Far East and Far East philosophies, turning toward pacifism and mysticism and sexual liberation and generally anti-war.
In a surrealist year of sandwich men and sunbathers, dead sunflowers and live telephones, housebroken politicos with party whips performed as usual in the rings of their sawdust circuses, where tumblers and human cannonballs fill the air like cries, when some cool clown pressed an inedible mushroom button and an inaudible Sunday bomb fell down, catching the president at his prayers on the 19th green.
And welcome back to the 35th annual Jerry Ford Palm Springs Desert Golf Rat Shoot. Well, the big surprise today, as we look up there at the leaderboard, is the sudden surge of presidential candidates among the front runners in the celebrity ranks. For a report on this phenomenon, at the ninth tee is Jack Rodenticus. Jack?
At the ninth tee with Ted Kennedy, sporting that thin mustache transplant, which I think makes him look very much like David Niven. His partner, Lee Trevino, just hit a very beautiful wood shot to the green, and now Kennedy is bending over the ball. There's that preppy backswing of his, so distinct.
The shot's hooking! Oh, over the bridge and into the water! That's really a bad stroke for Mr. Kennedy. He's in trouble now. He'll have to dive for that ball. And he's talking it over with family and friends. He's waving his hand, waving away the advice of a lawyer. It looks like, yes, he will dive for the ball now and call the police in the morning. Ed?
Well, indications right here in the clubhouse are that this could eliminate Kennedy from the hunt. But let's go to Sam Norvegicus at the 16.
Ed, a really big rat has just poked his head out of the tumbleweed just 3 feet from where Ronald Reagan's chip shot lies for a very possible birdie here on the ultra-tough 16th. Reagan has called for a double O-gauge shotgun. That's the one he used in the deadly desert MGM 1939, but it's a rather unusual choice here on the 16th. Most pros would have gone after that rat with a knife, but of course Reagan's been in this tournament before, and looks like he overshot with that and wounded his caddy, California Lieutenant Governor Mike Kerb, who was bending over to pick up the ball. That must be painful, and it's going to be tough on the rulemakers here because I don't remember this ever happening before. Of course, lately, I don't seem to remember anything. Ed?
Well, you're right, Sam. Nothing like that has ever happened before. And Breen Prance that the rat was... No. Oh, wait a minute. Let's just go down to Bill Sumatra there on the 17th.
President Jimmy Carter trying to take his tee shot, and he'll have to take it on a dogleg right. This is the first time the president has set foot outside the White House since the many international crises that have dominated his attention, except, of course, for those short, supervised, well-publicized trips to the bathroom. He's not going to play the shot? That is right. He's walking away from the tee. Must know something we do. Would you look at that? What a gorgeous move. He's smashed a rat flat that was hiding just behind a spectator. Smashed it flat.
Excuse me for interrupting, but back here on the ninth, Kennedy just shot an eagle.
Oh, well, that'll get him in trouble with environmentalists.
Yeah, but he used a fully automatic AR-14 on it.
That should be good with the NRA.
Definitely. I think so. So he's
gentlemen,
lost, really.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Let's go down to Ben Bland on the 19th.
Ed, it's really bad here. Those six rats that Jerry Brown wouldn't kill, and they got out of his three-piece suit, and look at that. They're taking over the best seats of the bar, and they're telling all of Ronnie Reagan's jokes in advance. This could really...
Sorry to cut in, Ben, but that's all the time we have now.
Here's another review of your life and work that I want your comment on. It comes from an FBI file. Beatnik rabble-rouser most surely responsible in some measure to demoralization in America.
But there's another sentence. Probably a nutcase. I got my FBI files through the American Freedom of Information Act. Yeah, I mean, that's almost as good as being on President Nixon's wish list of whom he'd like to get rid of or kill.
A badge of honor?
Yeah, badge of honor. Honor or offer.
Poor Nancy, she's fainted. I'll just wrap her skirt around her head like this to keep her warm. And now I'll press her body close to mine to keep me warm.
She looked so helpless there, spread-eagled on the floor. I beat the eagle off and gave her a quick mouth-to-mouth resuscitation job. And then it struck me...
What a sap she had!
The wit is always at the ready, humor ever there in the poetry. It is, to a great extent, what makes Ferlinghetti a successful populist, a well-loved poet, a well-read poet.
A well-read R.E.D.,
His messages are serious, but honey gathers more flies than vinegar. His social commentary is always clothed in whimsy, a twinkle of the eye, a lilt of poetic rhythm. And all these comic manners Ferlinghetti learned from a master, not a poet in so many words, but a master showman, Charlie Chaplin.
Even though he was a dirty communist, he was run out of the country, you know, moved back to England or into Switzerland, in disgust with American democracy.
What's your connection in terms of your work with Charlie Chaplin?
Well, he had an impact on everybody. I mean, he was a little man against the world. He was the little man in the derby, and the cane was Eros, the free spirit, the love spirit, innocent spirit against the cops of the world. His portrayal of the little man represented everything that fought against the fascist mentality and the powers of darkness.
Franco is dead, but so is Picasso. Chaplin is dead, but I'd wear his bowler. Having outlived all our myths but his, the myth of the pure subjective, the collective subjective, the little man in each of us, waiting with Charlo or Pozzo. On every corner I see them, hidden inside their tight, clean clothes. Their hats are not derbies, they have no canes, but we know them. We have always waited with them. They turn and hitch their pants and walk away from us, down the darkening road in the great American night.
Disco on the radio, finger popping Arab fry cooks, posses of actors out searching, smoking marijuana, wearing Chinese shoes, listening to Benny Goodman. Drinking coffee in a room full of women. Eating green cherries at sunset. Watching a TV travel at 65 northbound. Whores and dwarves hard by the boulevard. Rock stars in 50s cars. Universal must have paid for the moon. Oh. Unmistakably hash pipe smoking in the park where Rudolph Valentino and three soft-eyed bums share the grass. Valley Jews and children of the rich. One night papas make burgers with the kids, do for whole weekends of real life. Tonight, the Hollywood boulevards unroll toward sunset. Washington palms against a planetarium sky, fading toward a truly mournful Jap saxophone.
But after all, nevertheless, the world is a beautiful place to be born into, if you don't mind happiness not always being so very much fun. If you don't mind a touch of hell now and then, just when everything is fine. Because even in heaven, they don't sing all the time. The world is a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't mind some people dying all the time, or maybe only starving some of the time, which isn't half so bad if it isn't you. Oh, the world is a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't much mind a few dead minds in the higher places, or a bomb or two now and then in your upturned faces, or such other improprieties as our name-brand society is prey to, with its men of distinction and its men of extinction and its priests and other patrolmen, and its various segregations and congressional investigations and other constipations that our fool flesh is heir to. Yes, the world is the best place of all for a lot of such things as making the fun scene and making the love scene and making the sad scene and singing low songs and having inspirations and walking around looking at everything and smelling flowers and goosing statues and even thinking and kissing people and making babies and wearing pants and waving hats and dancing and going swimming in rivers on picnics in the middle of the summer and just generally living it up. Yes, but then, right in the middle of it, comes the smiling mortician.
When he died at the age of 101 in February, the New York Times published an obituary that quoted the publisher and writer saying, My newest poems are always my favorite poems.